Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today by an acclaimed visual artist and very independent filmmaker. She's known for her short films that combine music and ambient sound with multiple animation styles and techniques. Gail Noonan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, right now you're being celebrated by the Northwest Film Center in Portland. They've brought you down from British Columbia as one of the trailblazing women of independent animation. This is good company to be in.
Oh, I am so pleased to be with those other wonderful trailblazers. I feel very honored to be in their company.
Yeah, they're an amazing group of Northwest artists that include Ruth Hayes from Olympia, Washington, Joan Gratz, two-time Academy Award winner, plus Rose Bond, Joanna Priestley, and Marilyn Zornado.
No, I'm more than pleased and tickled pink and honored. And you know, I was telling my friends back home, I guess I have to fall off my perch now. I'm having a retrospective. That's it. I'm done. I'm finished. Over.
Well, you started out as a visual artist, mostly in printmaking. I understand that you grew up way out east on the eastern seaboard in rural Nova Scotia in Canada.
Yes.
And so what first drew you into the art scene?
Well, I was an awkward geek. So I was drawing was the refuge, and that was kind of how I could connect to people, was through drawing. So I always drew and went to art school. I wanted to go to a place as different from a village on the coast of Nova Scotia as I could possibly think of. So I thought, okay, a city in the prairies. So I applied to the University of Manitoba and ended up in Winnipeg, the smack dab in the middle of the country, where I went to art school and lived there, ended up majoring, focusing on printmaking, on etching, and lived there for the next 12 years.
Obviously in Winnipeg, it gets crazy cold, wind chill off the prairies. So you're inside a lot doing your art. And I'm assuming you have some opportunities to gather with other artists, although many of your pursuits would be solitary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, there was always a really good potluck, especially in winter. Well, winter and summer. And I found that mainly going through art school, it would be your classmates and their friends that would sort of form your cohort. And again, that would be quite cross-disciplinary, you know, where there would be a group of us who would be writers, visual artists, architects, musicians, filmmakers, the gamut. Yeah.
And you were a printmaker at the time.
Yes. I was part of North Nassau Printmakers, which was, again, a small cooperative group of printmakers that was then, the building we were in was turned into actually a big art center, which is now where the Winnipeg Film Group is and a number of other arts organizations. I think it's Martha Street Studios now. And it was a wonderful place to go work where there was common space. We all shared presses and the acids and the major infrastructure was there for printmaking. It was in the old district of Winnipeg where there were theaters and alternate galleries, plug-in gallery. So there was a nice little enclave there of sort of artist-run centers. That was a great area to be in.
What techniques, old and new, fascinated you about printmaking?
Well, the thing I loved about etching, I think I've always loved the... My drawing style was always about kind of creating little stories. And what I loved about etchings is that because you're working on a metal plate and you're scratching through an emulsion that you'll then etch, you pull a print and the plate makes a dent in the paper. So there's very much an enclosed world where the story in that etching lives. And also, the image is backwards. So you have to sort of think backwards and how the image is going to look forward. So you end up with this kind of objectivity about the images you're creating. So I love that little enclosed world. And I found that was the same thing once I sort of did this lateral transfer from printmaking into animation, because I was working with little stories, it seemed the next step was really make those stories come to life, make them move, and also incorporate sound and music. So what I found with film is that there was that same enclosed world in the screen. that became the world the characters could live in. So it made for a much sort of the next step in the evolution of that sort of storytelling style.
Well, when you did try your hand at filmmaking for the first time with your short film Play Ball, it was a big success, won awards, and so it sounds like that was when your filmmaking career got launched.
It was wonderful encouragement. I think the first experience, I went to a festival, the Yorkton Short Film and Video Festival, and that's where Play Ball won its the animation award, which absolutely shocked me to no end because I was up against very stiff competition. And also I was there. I was actually able to sort of witness it and meet other filmmakers that I'm actually still friends with to this day. And I think when you get that kind of encouragement right off the bat, it does help you keep making films. And you get to see how people respond to your work in an audience. And that, to me, is also, that's the culminating side of making a film. It's a time-based medium, which is the big difference between that and printmaking, is, you know, prints, I'm fine with people discovering my prints on their own time and they'll find them. But with film, the film has to be projected. So there's an opportunistic element to that. And also it's time-based. So people can only experience it for that set period of time.
Well, this is why it's so important to still have cinemas, still have places where people can gather together and watch a film on the big screen, is to connect with the artist in a real way, and to have the artist connect with the audience as well and get that feedback. It's almost like the filmmaker is an actor on stage, you know, in the live theater. No performance is ever the same way twice because it's an interaction between the performers and the audience.
Yes, and it's interesting, especially with short film, context is everything. So, yes, people bring their experiences to the film when they watch the film, and that can be very much colored by what they've seen before, just before, or what's happening in their life, you know. And so people will resonate with different aspects of a film. And it's always interesting to see when you show a film what people take away from it.
Now, you are known for your short films, and you've had great success with a whole series of short films and often very short films. The market seems to be somewhat not as broad for short films as it used to be, and maybe that's just in the U.S. I think there is still an interest in Europe, in Japan, maybe even in Canada, for short films on television. You know, not everybody needs to go in and make a feature.
Well, it's an interesting thing because I used to have a T-shirt that said short films are the laboratory of film. And what I find is that the short film programs in any festival I go to, that's where I'm most engaged and that's where I see most experimentation. And you see people veering away from the tried and true, because there isn't a huge amount of money involved. I mean, once you're into features, then suddenly with all those expenses, even with the cheaper way of making films now, there's a lot more at stake. So people tend to fall back into, well, A, there's a lot more people making decisions about what the story is going to be and how that story is going to be portrayed. I'm all for collaboration, but it has to be creative collaboration. It really can't be about whoever is bringing the money to the table deciding what's going to happen. I think that's where things can really go south, because if you're putting a lot of money into something, then you'll want to get your money back. Whereas with short film, really, it's about the storytelling and it's about the expression. So I find it vital, really vital and alive. You know, hats off to feature filmmakers. I can't wait to see Joanna Priestley's film, because I just think, wow, not only did she do a feature, an animated feature, it's an abstract animated feature. That's fantastic. So I'm impressed to that. And it's very, very inspiring, though. I do think I will always be concise and on the short side.
Sound is very important to you. Music, sound effects, ambient audio, And I think this is true of a lot of really successful animation filmmakers, is they realize that sound is half the project. People don't pay as much attention to it, but when it's not there or when it's not done well, it can really sink a film.
Oh, yes. I would almost say that sound is like 60, it's 60-40. Because, and also sound it can really help you establish an atmosphere and a sense of space that you don't have to create because it's there in the sound. And I think sound touches our psyche in a really immediate kind of way. So you can do all kinds of subliminal atmospheric things with layers and layers of sound. And people don't necessarily have to consciously be aware of what that sound is, but it will definitely affect them emotionally in a very subconscious way.
Well, your short film, Your Name in Cellulite, is a satire. And so many of your short films are very satirical. And the themes here are advertising culture and marketing and the beauty industry and women's bodies and body image. And these themes also come up in other films. You know, More Sensitive is another great satirical short film that I like. Obviously, you're inspired by audiences and how they react to that. What are some of your other inspirations? I mean, are you a fan of satirical literature, for example?
Well, I would say what I like to do is sort of draw analogies between the macro and the micro. So with Your Name in Cellulite, it was a combination of how a woman's body is viewed as something that's to be manipulated and shaped and contoured to the purpose of the other, of the observer, of whoever's going to consume this body. That's the same attitude as we have towards the earth. We can change the direction of rivers. We can pillage and mine and plunder and clear cut the earth. And the ramifications are the same. The same way that we approach women's bodies and increasingly men's, you know, because that's a whole other market share. You know, we can't miss that. But I really focused on that because it was so apparent to me that when this woman conforms to what is viewed as the prescribed image of femininity, which is also sort of an element of survival, you know, is she's so constrained, so restrained, so immobilized that her body just rebels. And I think the same thing is happening now with the world. The world is just rebelling. You know, we've messed around enough, and now it's just, you know, rolling over and threatening us along with it. It's like we have to smarten up really fast with the environment. We can't treat it in a cavalier fashion. It's not there just for us to use. It's an entity, and we are a part of that entity, not the ruler, not the owner. The same way no one's body is owned by anybody else. And you have to consider the entire ecology. So I think that's kind of more the direction where I come from. The same with More Sensitive. It's based on a film that a friend of mine wrote. It's a jazz singer. It's a self-parody, actually, of himself. He's a brilliant jazz musician, but it's a parody of his singing. And the song is about being more sensitive than everybody else, which in reality the singer isn't. So
sensitive new age guy.
Yes, sensitive new age guy. And you know, when I fall in love, it hurts me more than you can never possibly imagine. So again, I bring in elements of the environment. You know, when he falls in love, it's a box of chocolates and the chocolates explode. And then there's lots of little orca whales that come up. And then the ocean is actually a sea of styrofoam and tampons and detritus. That is the thing I like to play with, is how can we take our immediate personal experience and look at it in terms of the broader context.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm talking today with animator and visual artist Gail Noonan. She's known for her short films that combine music and ambient sound with multiple animation styles and techniques. So many of your films, Menopause Song, Your Name in Cellulite, these are themes that women can immediately relate to, and men can be introduced to these topics in an aha sort of manner. So do you sort of see yourself as an educator, as somebody who's trying to expand the conversation out there?
No, I'm incredibly selfish with my film. I make films I want to see. So I make films and subjects that I'm interested in. I try really not to think of the audience at all. And I don't take a pedantic view at all in my filmmaking. I really like it when things resonate with people. I mean, when I made my film, Your Name in Cellulite, I seriously had no idea that people would respond to it as broadly as they did. I mean, I saw older women saying, I'm never wearing, I'm throwing out those high heel shoes. I saw fathers saying, I'm going to get this for my daughter. I'm going to get this. Young men saying, I'm getting this for my wife and my girlfriend. It crossed a lot of lines. And I really made that film for something that I needed to see at the time. You know, I was looking at a lot of bizarre plastic surgery, Botox, liposuction. A lot of women were experiencing eating disorders, starving themselves to death. And it was actually realizing that women were dying from these attempts to attain this so-called image of perfection. So it was something I really needed to see. And, you know, with the Menopause Song, I actually wrote the song first, and I wrote it in a really bad day of cramps, and I just needed some kind of relief. You know, this is going to end someday. I was just really expressing something for myself. So when other people vibe into it, that's the best. That's great, because I really don't have any intention, really, of consciously educating or consciously trying to sway anybody's opinion or anything. But if you can come along for the ride, if it actually engages you to watch and to listen, and it makes you think, oh, wow, that's bonus. That's wonderful. I'm happy.
This is the place that creative people find themselves in all the time, writers and artists. They want to find a book, a film, a story to look at, to take in, and it's not there. So, dagnabbit, I guess I'm going to have to make it myself.
Well, it's an interesting state to get in, to think that you can take some concept from a thought and actually bring it to life and bring it to something that other people can see and hear and experience. I think once you make that leap, that's one of the best experiences. I used to teach for a while too, and I would tell my students, you don't have to stay a filmmaker or an animator. The best thing you can know that you can get out of this is that you can take something from idea to completion. And know that you can bring that, something that you has just been in your head, you can bring it into the world. And then other people can share it. Other people will experience this too.
The techniques that you use in your animation, they're just so wide-ranging. Everything from drawn animation to collage to clay to objects. Mm. But the one thing that seems to be missing, unless I've missed something, is I haven't seen any computer-generated imagery from you, no computer animation. So your work seems just very tangible. There's something when I look at your short films, I just sort of imagine being able to reach out and touch everything that's on the screen.
I am a very sort of tactile person. And I've found that computer-generated imagery isn't really something that speaks to me. I've seen other people do it very, very well, but not for me. And the way that you need to engage in just the creative methods for computer-generated imagery and computer animation, you know, working more with graphs and vectors rather than actually moving something a frame at a time. I mean, that's just sort of my tradition and my way of doing things. But I actually did make a computer-generated film. Well, I made it using an Amiga back in 1996. And I discovered...
I remember the Amiga.
Oh, the Amiga was just the best. It really was the best because I was only going to use it as a recording device, as a capture device. And then I accidentally grabbed an object direction. I accidentally moved the mouse, and it painted with that object. And I realized, oh, this is a tool. You can do things with a computer that you can't do other ways. And I've never really been able to recapture that trying to use After Effects or Photoshop or any of the other sort of currently available programs. I know it can happen. I know. I have a bit of an attitude issue, I think, with them. But anyway, I made that film in 96. I created a sort of set of laws for myself. I could only use 48 photographs of a group that I was singing with at the time and images from garden catalogs that I got in the mail. And we sang the song. It was a song I'd written called The Menopause Song in a studio on island. It was the latest technology, digital recording, but it was powered off a car battery and one microphone. So we sang around that microphone. And as the lights grew dim, we sang around a candle because there wasn't enough power to have both the light on and this recording and mixing board powered, you know, in this off-grid sound studio. So that's how I made my first only computer-generated film. But then I veered back to my cell painting and very traditional ways and shooting on film.
I remember Linda Barry talking about how she had trouble writing a book on her laptop. And then she just got out reams of paper and crayons. Mm-hmm. And that opened it up. Just being that tactile opened up something between the mind and the body.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, so your work as a printmaker with all the textures and etching and embossing, it seems like that really informed how you would tackle making a film.
I think I've always been attracted to ritual, and there's a very strong ritual and craft, the element of craft. So there's a very strong ritual in printmaking where you prepare the surface and you bevel the edges and you polish the plate. So you do a lot of work before you ever scratch the surface of the plate. And with animation, there's the same thing where you punch the paper, you create your sets, that's right.
Yeah.
And also you can do a lot of editing in the storyboard stage. You can do a lot of pre-planning. And then there's that element of repetition. You have to get into kind of a very zen sort of state. And even though I've departed from, I used to quite rigorously storyboard and quite religiously follow that storyboard in my planning process, now I actually try to do what's called straight ahead animation. I just try to intuitively let the images flow as they will. I'll start out with a game plan, but if it departs from that, it can go where it will. But I find that you still get in that particular sort of state of mind, or you're almost in a kind of alternate reality at that point. And I think that follows through from the printmaking as well. Even though it's no longer a literal narrative, you're kind of in the flow of this series of ideas.
Some of my favorite animation directors are traditional artists, you know, not so much the computer effects people. And they're also women. Marjan Satrapi, Nora Toomey, Joanna Quinn. And I think that also has something to say about how women directors have been neglected for so long by the big studios, who are generally more taken with the flashy, shiny things. It's getting better, but it's getting better slowly.
Yes, I agree. And part of that is, I think there's been an economic imperative behind that. And it harkens back to what we were talking about earlier, how it takes a lot of money to make feature films. And so they must make their money back. And there isn't a lot of faith in a type of storytelling that might be a little more introspective, that might be less sensational, but more taking you along a different experiential path, because it's riskier. And also you're getting into a kind of territory that might make a lot of funders uncomfortable. You know, excitement, humor is great and horror is great. it engages people in a really obvious, visible, they laugh, they scream. But when you take people on a more thought-provoking and or more emotive experience, then you don't see right away if it's having an impact on people.
So your short films play at a lot of screenings and festivals and at this retrospective at the Northwest Film Center. But gosh, I've been having a hard time finding out where to get hold of a collection of your films. Can you help me out on that front?
In the old video days, I used to have a collection. It was called The Laughing Feminist, which was the first four films. Playball, Two Beautiful Stars, Your Name and Cellulite, and The Menopause Song were on that compilation. And then since then, I've kind of fallen off the wagon of that sort of marketing and very practical, how do you get to see my films? I have a YouTube channel. I have a Vimeo channel. But I'm really amiss. I have two distributors, Women Make Movies. They distribute Your Name and Cellulite. And then there's Moving Images in Vancouver that distributes everything else. But I really have to get a grip on how people can actually see a collection of the films. So that's a good nudge. It's a very good prompt.
Well, tell our listeners how to find out more about your work, please.
Well, I do have a website, Cartoon and Films, CartoonAn Films. And you'll find out about the films there. And I'm starting to develop that site a lot more so that there'll be links to be able to see the films online. Then after that, I'm building a tower and broadcasting from
a tower.
No,
okay.
Yeah. I'm going to take over the lighthouse on Main Island and broadcast from there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is it a working lighthouse?
Unfortunately, well, yes and no. It has the equivalent of about a 60 watt bulb that's solar powered that does do its circuit at night. You can see it, but the foghorn has been disengaged. But the building is standing, and they're keeping the area as a park, which is very nice because it's on a beautiful shoreline, gorgeous sunrises and sunsets. So,
okay, you've convinced me. I have to come visit you.
Yes, yes, of course, of course.
Hop the ferry.
Yes, hop a plane, hop a ferry.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today has been animator and visual artist Gail Noonan. Gail, thank you so much for dropping by today.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity. And it's been lovely to visit Portland.
Well, many thanks to all our listeners today on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/words and pictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @words and picture.